Oxygen number 12404, real 4.
Commander Brown, real 4. You were just
right. Sorry.
You were just saying how the adrenaline started to flow once you got airborne.
Yeah. We then moved up to Accrington Drem, where we got a lot of new pilots and spent a fair amount of time teaching them fighter tactics. Quite a number of polls I see, or checks. Vakukal, Kapetsky, I remember Kapetsky. Makriya Jowsey, strange names, these chaps.
Did their attitude towards going into fighting the Germans seem to be any different from the British?
Oh, I think they had a real hate for the Hun. A real hate. I don't see what else would have brought them into the war other than supreme desire to kill Huns. They really did hate them.
Did you hear the Germans?
Not really. Not really. Didn't know enough about them. I can't say I'm very fond of them now, having read and seen what has happened since the war started. But I think one's attitude to dogfighting was destroying the enemy aircraft, not the enemy itself. That was just part and parcel of it. So we're up in Drem, building up the squadron again, until when we were posted to Castletown to form 260 Squadron. A chap called Ben Bowering and myself. Ben is still around, lives in
yes, I know him.
Godalming area. Great rugger player, Ben. Harlequin, I believe, in his day. And a banker. And off we went to Castletown in December 40. I've forgotten to add that we also went up to Dyce, 111 Squadron, went to Dyce after Drem for a couple of months. Aberdeen.
Was that quiet?
That's quiet, the odd scramble. I was about the only chap that had done any night flying. And I used to do most of the night flying there. So I used to get scrambled out of Montrose because Dyce was being rebuilt with Ron Myers. So it was always Brown doing the night flying out of Montrose. Station commander never liked any lights there. I remember on one occasion getting so fed up waiting for the flare path that I took off without any flare path at all, only to be told that I missed the flare path crew by about 4 feet with their Bedford truck as they were motoring out to put the flares down. So I suppose I'm lucky to have survived that. Wait. So 260 Squadron up to Castletown.
When you said that we went to form the new squadron, do you mean you and Ben Bowering?
Ben Bowering, and can't remember the name of the flight of the squadron commander. Can't remember. Anyhow, we had a bunch of new pilots, and again, it was teaching them tactics and formation and things of that sort.
Where is Castletown?
Castletown, believe it or not, is north of Wick. So here we are in December, north of Wick. And then, believe it or not, they built another airfield even north of Castletown, and it was called Skitten. And we went to Skitten, where, if I remember rightly, Christmas Day 1940, we had a bottle of rum which the doc found, and that was the lot for the whole squadron, airmen as well as officers. Again, looking after the Navy. Nothing done other than training. Did very little, very few scrambles. We weren't truly operational, really. I see I scrambled and picked up a Wellington.
This was the Hurricane Squadron, was it?
Yes, Hurricane Squadron. Saw our first Americans. I see I had a flight with a Colonel Taylor, and I'm pretty sure he was American. We were trying out some U.S. Air Corps formations, so there must have been an American round giving us the gen on this. Anyhow, here we are in Skitten. Met my first Russian on the 19th of December, and he was flying a Hurricane. We went dogfighting together.
But the Russians were supposed to be neutral then.
Well, there's a Russian. Dogfighting with Russian. It was December the 19th, 1940. So where he came from, I wouldn't know. Next Russian I met was when I was in the Air Fighting Development Unit. And he tested a Hurricane. No, it could well have been this chap this time. Because he'd put it downhill so fast, he'd torn the rear combing at the back of the cockpit off, which was fabric. So he really bent it. So again, nothing of any operational significance. Odd aeroplanes appear. There's a Fox Moth here I flew for some reason or other. Oh, Flight Lieutenant Bowring, Ben Bowring was in it. Magister. I suppose that was a Squadron Magister. Back to Castletown. Nothing. Drem, dice, all formation flying, experience, training. January. No operational significance. Then come January the February the 9th, I was posted to the Air Fighting Development Unit.
What was that?
The Air Fighting Development Unit was really the development extension of the old Air Fighting Development Establishment, which I mentioned earlier was at Northolt. And this was responsible for working out fighter tactics in the main. Testing new aircraft as they enter the service. And that was the most interesting part of my flying career, because we got all the new types coming in. We got the captured German aircraft, the captured Italian aircraft. And I was a flying officer then. And we had lots of fun.
Why was it such fun?
Well, you kept climbing into a new aeroplane. I see on one occasion, 1 month, I think it was July 41, I flew 17 different types.
Where was this place?
Duxford. You know, as I go through, I joined them in February. I flew Hurricane, Spitfire, Gladiator, Stinson, Reliant. Pusmoff, Blenheim.
Which was your favourite aircraft to fly?
I go back to the dear old Fury. No. I never flew jets operationally. I never flew jets solo. I flew in jets many times. I say the Fury was a delight. I never met an American aeroplane which I really liked. Mustang was a good aeroplane. Like, I'm talking now sheer pleasure to fly as against operational efficiency. The Boston I liked. Two beautifully smooth, powerful engines that you... Just like a great big American saloon motor car, I always thought it was. And we got all of these at Duxford. I see Tomahawk, Mohawk, Aerocobra. And then, of course, we got the developments of our own aeroplanes. We got the four-cannon Hurricane. We got the cannon Spitfire. We got the Hurricane Bomber. And it was quite amusing, really, because... I can scarcely remember reading any pilot's notes on these aeroplanes. One just climbed in the cockpit. How do you start it? How do you stop it? You know, what's about the approach speed? And one climbed in and took it off and played with it. You know, I flew the 109 there. Just climbed in and went.
What did you think of the 109?
Well, it was a good aeroplane. It had its weaknesses. It would bite you if you weren't careful.
In what way?
At low speeds in particular. Accelerated well. Hadn't got a particularly good view over the nose for a deflection shooting.
Did you get any...
But apart from the fact it was faster, I can well understand, than the Hurricane, we always knew we could outmaneuver it, and we could, of course. I mean, if a 109 got on your tail and you knew he was there, you had to be a bit unlucky if you were caught out. Because you really could haul the old Hurricane round and get inside him without any trouble at all. But the moment it came to trying to outclimb the chap and getting advantage, or outdive him for that matter, then you came second. But the Spit, particularly the Spit 9 onwards, had always got the measure of the 109 until the 190 came along, of course, and then that was another step forward for the Germans.
Some people say that the cockpit of the 109 was incredibly cramped.
No, not really. Not really. If you wanted a cramped cockpit, it was the Aerocobra. I mean, that really was a cramped cockpit. If you're over 5'9", you were resting your head against the roof. No, I didn't think the 109 was incredibly cramped. It was certainly smaller than a Spit cockpit. But I never thought it was anything exceptional.
Was there any aeroplane which you detested flying? Or disliked flying?
No. Because I like flying aeroplanes. And it was always seemed to me a bit of an adventure. No. Don't think so.
How exactly did you go about this development of air fighting in this unit?
Well, again, we would we would do performance check on the aeroplanes, and they would post down the odd aeroplane, like the Magister, I remember. Don't think we ever saw the Lank when I was there. And we would do the usual Stirling, either beam attacks, head-on attacks, rear attacks. Gave their gunners experience of where to see where the attacks were coming from. We would experiment with new types of attack, and they would tell us whether they could get a bead on us or not. And I suppose someone thought it was useful. Whether it was or not, I wouldn't know.
I think that after Duxford, you went to the Air Ministry in October 1941.
Yes, I went to the Ministry of Aircraft Production. I went to the Ministry of Aircraft Production to an outfit which was called RDQF. Now, that stood for Research and Development Equipment Fighters. A misnomer. There was also a bomber section and a coastal section, but we did no research and development whatsoever. Our job was to approve the layout of cockpits in fighter and training aircraft. To be chairman of all mock-up conferences of new aircraft types. To approve modifications to cockpits in any form they took, radio change, instrument change, ejection seats, for example. And that, too, was a very interesting job. I was told by the CEO of the outfit that he'd picked me because he'd known of my activities in AFDU and that I'd been Horton trained, and so he said, "You're the sort of chap I'm looking for." So I joined him. He was a fellow called Buckle, huge man, later president of the Lancia Motor Car Club. And when he was explaining to me what the job involved over a pint of beer somewhere near Westminster, I remember saying, "I've often wondered who the chap was that laid out the controls in the Blenheim." So he said, "Why?" I said, "Well, he was an idiot." He said, "Well, thank you, pilot officer. It was me."
What was your criticism?
Well, the only reason, I was probably the idiot. As I said, one never got any dual instruction flying new types at AFDU. You just climbed into it. And the first twin I ever flew was a Blenheim. And I climbed into this Blenheim all on my own. And off I went. And hidden behind the cockpit seat on the left-hand side were, if I remember rightly, four knobs. Two of them changed the pitch of the propeller after takeoff, and the other two operated the idle cutoffs. And I celebrated my first takeoff by putting the idle cutoff button on the port engine instead of feathering the prop. That caused a little bit of excitement for a few seconds until I got it right, but I felt it wasn't the brightest way of laying out cockpits. So our aim was to try and get rid of cockpit confusion if we could. It wasn't easy, because so often one inherited a cockpit and then had to try and do something with it. And in the end, we formed what was called the Standardized Cockpit Committee, in which we endeavoured to get all flat levers were the same shape and the same size, all undercarriage levers were the same shape and the same size, and no matter what aeroplane you climbed into, if the knob was that shape, then it was the undercarriage knob. I think it was a very desirable aim. Had an interesting time there with the development of the Martin Baker ejection seat. Of course, Martin Bakers weren't the only people doing it. ML Aviation had a contract from the MAP, or Ministry of Supply as it then was, to develop the seat. Sir James, being Sir James, wouldn't take a contract from the Ministry. His outlook was, when it works, I'll sell it to you. And I was in with Jimmy right from the beginning of the ejector seat. In fact, the first ride on the ground that I had was in his machine shop, where he had a rig which was 12 feet high, and a cartridge which fired you up in the air. I was persuaded to sit in this thing and pull the knob, and I've never felt such a kick up my pants in all my life. And funnily enough, the end result was I sprained both ankles, which may seem a bit strange, but my feet were resting on bars, so the toes were protruding. And we went up so fast that the toes went down and sprained my ankles. Not long afterwards, a journalist from one of the flying magazines, I don't think he was a flight man, maybe an aeroplane man, took a seat in it and did some quite severe damage to his spine. And Jimmy immediately saw that this was not the way to do it. He got on very well with the Institute of Aviation Medicine, and they used to come along and help him. And he had a lady friend who was a doctor, a surgeon, who lent him a complete spinal column, a real one, which he used to keep in his drawer, to tell him how the spinal column worked, and what you could do with it and what you couldn't. And he learnt that all you could do really was to compress the spine first and then hit it. So he then produced the twin cartridge, in which the initial shot compressed you and the second shot knocked you out of the aeroplane. Again, I think I was the first chap to ride in that one, because he asked me to bring down the director of aircraft development, a fellow called Serby, John Edward Serby, to have a look at this thing. And he then had a 50-foot rig out in his car park. And said, well, come on, Brownie, climb in. And he said, no, strap yourself in. And I said, well, what's this one do, Jimmy? He said, oh, this is a nice ride. You'll find this is all right. So I pull the hood down over my eyes and damn great bang, and I'm 50 feet up in the air. So I pass a few words to Jimmy about catching me out on this one. He said, well, how are you feeling? I said, well, fine. Oh, jolly good, he said. You're the first chap to ever ride with this. So they ratchet me down, and Jimmy then explains to Serby that he's done this new cartridge, and the whole idea is that it'll compress the spine and be no damage. And he discussed it with the Institute of Aviation Medicine, and they seemed to be happy with it. So from then on, Jimmy got his first contract. That was to put, to take the rear tank out of a Meteor, the one behind the cockpit, and put the seat in there. So he put the seat in there, and put a new hood over it, obviously, and started to do his live ejection test from then on. Great chap, marvellous engineer, but by golly, a difficult man to work with. He wanted me to work for him, but I said, no thanks, Jimmy.
Why was he so difficult?
He was Irish, didn't suffer fools gladly, and found the system more than he could put up with, really, and I frankly wouldn't blame him for that. When I say the system, I mean the civil service system that he had to work with in the Ministry of Supply.
What was his name?
Martin Baker. He designed his own aeroplanes, very good aeroplanes, fighter aeroplanes. Could never get a contract for them. He designed a magnificent 20mm automatic feed for 20mm guns. That went into production. He designed the cutters for the balloon barrage wires, which went onto bombers. He designed a mobile 25-pounder gun when he heard that the army in the Western Desert were towing these things behind them, then turning them around so they could fire at the enemy. He really was an amazing man. Amazing man. Lived to a ripe old age. And has saved thousands of lives.
Were you happy doing this kind of work, or were you itching to get back to operations?
No, I'd come off flying. Doctors had caught up with me and decided that I was not to fly for a bit. I then transferred to the engineering branch because they were very keen to have pilots go back to becoming engineers and have pilot engineers. And I stayed with the Ministry of Supply until I retired in 1947. So I had a fairly long session with them.